Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Today on From Embers, we're going to stay on theme and continue thinking through the shutdown Canada phenomenon in recent historical context. Last episode, one of my co-hosts spoke with Indigenous anarchist author and artist Gord Hill about the so-called Oka Crisis at Gunasatage Mohawk Territory in 1990, which is an important reference point for the return of warrior culture across this country and an early example of large-scale disruptive solidarity actions in Native communities from coast to coast. This week, we're going to speak with a non-Native anarchist who spent time at the land reclamation site and highway blockade at Six Nations of the Grand River near Hamilton, Ontario. As the name implies, members of all Six Nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy live on the territory, and despite being the largest reserve in Canada, the 46,000-acre territory only represents about 5% of the treaty lands originally agreed upon in the 1784 Haldimand Treaty, following the American Revolutionary War. In 1992, Henco Industries claimed to have purchased 100 acres of land within the Haldimand Tract. The Six Nations Council sued the government over the land. In 2005, a subdivision plan for the property was approved by the government of Ontario, and the developer started construction. In February 2006, community members from Six established a camp blocking access to the development site and renamed it Gunnenstatten, which means the protected place. In a sequence of events that by now might sound familiar, the developer obtained a legal injunction, which the warriors proceeded to burn and broadcast on local television. In the early hours of April 20th, Ontario Provincial Police raided the camp and made 21 arrests. Later that day, several hundred community members rallied, many wearing masks and armed with sticks, pushed the police back and retook the site, expanding it to blockade Highway 6 and kicking off a months-long standoff with police and increasingly racist agitators, including known white supremacists who relocated to the nearby town of Caledonia and attempted to stoke vigilante backlash. In June, the provincial government bought out the developer and negotiations have continued since over the Haldimand Tract. This significant sequence of events reveals some of the complexities of settler Indigenous solidarity as waves of non-Native supporters arrived at the site in the days following the raid, dramatically changing the dynamics on the ground. Many warriors, land defenders, and anarchists have since reflected on this experience and attempted to learn from it for solidarity efforts moving forward. It seems particularly important today with Wet'suwet'en camps out west asserting jurisdiction and refusing the Coastal GasLink pipeline, and other Indigenous-led camps across the country established following RCMP raids on Gadimden and Unistoten. For this episode, I'm speaking with a non-Native anarchist who was present at the Six Nations reclamation site for several weeks, both before and after the police raid. In fact, we met each other for the first time at the camp and have stayed friends over the years. So it was actually kind of nice for me to get the chance to pick his brain about this stuff 14 years later. We talk about his arrival at the reclamation site, dynamics before and after the raid, and his reflections on anarchist Indigenous solidarity moving forward.
Yeah, I'm from the Ontario region, basically the so-called Ontario region, and started getting involved in politics when I was a teenager, came out of the punk scene. Sort of, I think, because of that, the punk culture and stuff, I think I was a little more oriented toward anarchism from the get-go. And in terms of getting involved with what was going on in Six Nations, that came pretty soon after I had returned from doing some solidarity work in Colombia, which certainly informed that present moment in my life and my desire to get involved with what was going on in Six Nations.
Would you be willing to talk a bit about what was going on in Colombia and how that affected you?
Yeah, definitely. I ended up hooking up with a small collective out of Montreal, and it was Proyecto de Acompañamiento y Solidaridad con Colombia, PASC. I hooked up with them. I was pretty young. I also want to add that in for the interview. this is talking 14, 15 years ago, so just keep that in mind. It was a while ago.
Fair enough.
And, but anyway, I had gone down to Colombia with a small collective that was doing direct solidarity work with communities down there, mostly Afro-Colombian communities and Mestizo and Campesino communities. And that was sort of a very, that's kind of a whole interview in of itself or whatever. That's a long discussion, but I guess it was a very intense sort of experience for me, living amongst those communities in regions where they were being actively displaced and torn from their lands. And they would be like traditional territories. They have sort of a recognition very similar to what people would see in Canada with Indigenous territories, in the sense that, yeah, they do have sort of traditional territories with the Afro-Colombians who got together with Indigenous people when they had escaped slavery, was sort of the basics of how these old territories began, was escaped slaves meeting and intermingling with Indigenous folks in Colombia and forming their own communities and that sort of thing. So it was very interesting sort of to, you know, to come from a scenario in Colombia as an international doing solidarity work, living amongst those communities and working with them toward self-determination and getting their lands back and so on. And then coming back to Canada and having a very similar scenario occurring in my mind, it was the lines were very clear that the same thing was happening here. And of course, it's very interesting when most, you know, people from North America or Europe, whatever, Canada look at a scenario like Colombia, they think there's all kinds of assumptions that go into their mind about how the government is and how the state of the situation is down there and how that's so different than what occurs up here. But of course, I very much saw the similarities to how the government dealt with Indigenous people and Afro-Colombians down in Colombia and in how they were being dealt with for all years since colonization up here in Canada. So for me, it was a very direct, you know, I was very impassioned at the time, and it was a no-brainer to me that when I heard about the call to go to Six Nations, it was a no-brainer that that was in a natural sort of connection with what I was already politically committed to, I guess, and involved with.
So you said there was a call that went out to join the reclamation camp at the site of the subdivision that was being built, right? So how did that sort of come to your attention and what, yeah, like what sort of drew you to actually go there?
Basically, I was sort of no fixed address at the time, I suppose. And I can't really recall directly how I heard the call out. It was just sort of an organic thing through networks, I suppose, of people who are concerned about these types of things and talking about them. And it was a call out, sorry, I should clarify. The call out that I heard about was from the clan mothers of the Six Nations territory, that they had asked for supporters to come and join them on the lines there to defend their territory, which had been usurped for a housing development, and that they had been occupying the entrance to that and stopping the building. So I heard about that, and someone I knew was driving down there, and so I jumped in the car to go on and sort of take it from there. It wasn't a hugely thought out, prepared thing. It was just very much, I felt like, you know, this was action worth taking.
Okay, and so can you tell us a bit about what it was like when you first arrived, first started trying to make connections with people and navigating the space? And I think it's important also to point out that this was before the raid and before a big wave of non-Native people showed up to support. So I'm assuming it was a little bit quieter then than it was when I personally got there, which was after the raid.
Yeah, that's right. It was pretty quiet. At the time, it wasn't really major news or anything like that, which is why I probably first heard it just through sort of networks and connections of people who care. And yeah, when I got there, it was pretty quiet. Maybe, you know, 6 to 8 people sitting around the sacred fire. They had a sacred fire at the entrance to the site. There's a bunch of sort of half-built homes. There was one completely built home that was the display home or whatever for the folks who were trying to sell or do the development. However, everyone there, like, you know, the clan mothers and all the people who were hanging out at the sacred fire and just holding that entrance point, they didn't touch any of those homes or anything like that. It was a very, you know, chilled out atmosphere. They had said, I believe, to the company that, you know, they could come and retrieve their things and bring them out and leave, like they weren't intending to take their lumber or what have you and this kind of thing. It was just simply that they were not allowing them to build on this land. Yeah, so it was relaxed, people around the fire. It was, you know, I came in and I was a stranger. I didn't know people. They didn't know me. It took a while for people to, like, warm up to me, which I think is totally normal. And at first, yeah, I recall, like, you know, there's some suspicion of, like, who is this guy anyway, you know? Definitely, like, you know, the racial tension of being I'm a white guy. And so a lot of tension there and lack of, you know, any reference point for them where a white guy would be on side with them, I guess. And so I spent a lot of time listening, just chopping wood and that kind of thing. I brought a little tent with me. There was a few things on the call that I had understood that they needed some tents and stuff like that. So I brought a tent, I had my sleeping bag, that kind of thing. And yeah, it was really just a lot of sitting around the fire, having smokes and chopping wood and starting to get to know each other. And as those days went by, you know, as you do, and as they saw that I was there and I guess I wasn't too much of a bother, that yeah, we got along and started forming more relationships, having good jokes and stuff like that. People floated in and out. There were not really many settlers who answered that call in the way that I did, in the sense that I came and set up to stay overnight for a bunch of nights. There was almost no police presence that I can't remember any tense police presence moments or anything like that. I knew that some negotiations were going on and discussions were going on. I'd hear them just around the fire, but you know, I was no part of that that process really. I was just there as a body, you know.
Were you open and sort of forward with your anarchist politics specifically? And did you sort of try to explain that, how that led you to want to be there? Or was it a more organic kind of like feeling out relationships kind of piece, and the politics kind of came through how you interacted?
Yeah, I would say the politics came from how we interacted more than anything. I don't remember getting into political discussions about my orientation toward anarchism or anything like that. If anything, we probably talked more about, you know, Colombia and what was going on down there, and maybe that gave a little bit of insight as to, you know, my own history and my own interest thereby to be there and supporting the folks at Six. But no, I don't remember really having direct talks about anarchism stuff. That's not really my style anyway in most contexts. So, So yeah, it was just more an organic growing of relationship and understanding. You know, when you answer a call to solidarity, I suppose it's not, you know, it's not like I'm sitting at a table informing these folks that I'm answering the call to about, oh, this is how I think things should be done, or this is where my framework is from. It's more like listening and understanding where they're coming from, I suppose. So, and that to me was very, like, I very much liked where they were coming from, really, because I just, I liked the fact that they were directly reclaiming their land. That made a lot of sense to me. The issue is clear. I have an understanding of the colonial history of Canada and the Haudenosaunee people. You know, I started to get a deeper understanding. Like, at that time, my understanding was less. Like, it has been a bunch of years now. And I like to think my understanding has grown since then. But at the very core basis, it was pretty simple, you know? Yeah, in terms of any other times where I felt maybe unwelcome or something like that. Well, as I said, I never felt unwelcome in the sense of someone saying, you shouldn't be here, go home, you know, this is not your struggle. But there were definitely, like, moments of, you know, people just kind of more being upset with me for being white, you know, and also in the sense of, like, your government, you're this, you're that. Which I understand, like, I, you know, as you know, a person who doesn't affiliate with the government and doesn't believe in it, you know, like, it's annoying when people put that on you and start talking to you like you're a friend with the MP or something. But it's also totally understandable. Like, it doesn't really set me off. Like, and I think non-Indigenous people, particularly white people who show up at these things, got to be ready to hear a bit of that.
What was going on at that time, again, prior to the raid with white folks, primarily white folks in Caledonia? Because I know there was a lot of kind of like far-right agitation within the white community of Caledonia afterwards. But had that started yet? And was there, like, were people driving by in their trucks and yelling stuff, or were things pretty calm at this point? Not to say nothing of the long history of tension, you know, between those two communities, but specifically at the camp, was that an ongoing thing that was happening?
Yeah. No, I don't remember, not for the little time I was there, you know. I mean, and the time I was there doesn't really represent the whole time that camp existed, so I don't want to make an idea like I saw it from start to finish, because that wasn't the case. I just came at the time when the Clan Mothers made a call out. So it's not like I would have seen every interaction. I wasn't tuned in to the internet or anything like that. So really my experience was very much direct on the ground, what I heard on the ground, what I saw on the ground. And, you know, I wasn't a part of the meetings and stuff like that, where I'm sure more of that those types of things would have been discussed. But I can't remember any, you know, right-wing people coming up, and I don't really remember people driving by and yelling stuff. You know, it also has to be mentioned that, like, I understood from the people at Six, you know, like, these are two communities, the white community of Caledonia, or whatever, if you want to call it white community, it's a mixed community of Caledonia and neighboring Six Nations. I mean, they're right by each other, so there's a lot of intermingling. Like, people do have friends and in the community and stuff like that, and I know tensions can sometimes grow, but also there is some support from that community there, from friends of people and so on. Things were starting to look, I guess, a little more like maybe the cops would move in or something like that. The police had said they would give some sort of a warning to allow like women and elderly and children to leave. This was like part of an agreement that was talked about, I guess, with folks there. And then there was this sort of gathering, of which I wasn't participating, but I was welcome to, like, just a witness, I guess. Like, it wasn't a secret thing. They were just discussing, and they were all discussing what to do if the cops decided to move in. How would they react, and what would happen? And one person suggested, well, we could all... I would like to suggest, like, the possibility of passive resistance. And everyone kind of nodded and listened and said, okay, so, like, what do you... And someone said, like, what do you mean? And so they went on to explain themselves and said, well, if the cops move in, we can all, like, lie down on the ground and get carried away. And immediately, like, the whole meeting, like, came up in raucous laughter, like, which is, like, you know, not necessarily the nicest way to respond to someone who's bringing a proposal. Like, I would, but, like, it was just, he just kind of went up in raucous laughter. And then this other guy was like, if you want to be a good little Indian, lie down, that's fine, but no way for me. And that was, like, pretty much the end of that discussion. That was the first place I had ever been where the concept of passively letting yourself be taken away as a strategy of resistance was, like, kind of out there. To that group, they were just like, well, how can you possibly defend the land if you just lie down and get taken away by the police? Like, you know, there's no way I'm submitting myself to that. And that was very clear, even though it was, you know, feedback to that person who suggested that in a pretty harsh kind of way. But, like, it was just so clear that it was pretty interesting for me from my experience of, you know, more like settler, you know, organizing and stuff around these big summits and everything. It was like, that was always this big debate that took up tons of time and space. And there was just like, no way, we're protecting the land, and you don't protect it by lying down.
So what happened with the raid?
So the cops had made this agreement that they would give this notice so that people could, you know, people who didn't want to be subject to, like, police violence could depart. The cops didn't honor that agreement, as is all too usual with police and negotiating and generally wider, you know, agreements between any authority in Canada and Indigenous nations. That's, like, the common thing. You make an agreement and you don't honor it. So that happened with the police then. We had gone to sleep that night, and usually at night, like, we kind of took different watches, so there'll be someone awake at the fire, keeping it going. It was early morning, something like that. I woke up to the sounds of the cops, and I was in my tent, and I jumped out of my tent, came out and saw a bunch of cops around. They were taking people down. As I said, like, it was pretty chill when I was there, so there's probably only 6 or 8 of us there anyway. There wasn't that many people. I don't remember many people. And the cops came in, a lot of them, took a bunch of people down. As soon as I came out of my tent, one of them grabbed me, and I shook them off, and then 3 more came on and took me down. Like, we got brought over to this paddy wagon, and in the paddy wagon we started, you know, singing and getting raucous or whatever. Like, people were pumped. We didn't know what was going on outside, really. I can't remember what the police were yelling at the time when they came in, but it was something like, you know, clear out of the way, you're going to be arrested, right? So some people had stood over to the side. Anyone who had even stood up and not moved to the side was immediately, you know, taken out by a handful of cops, would tackle them and zip tie them and all that. And yeah, I remember in the paddy wagon, there was some guy, I don't know who he was, but I could hear him. And we had sung some songs and everything. And then we heard the paddy wagon door open, and the cop talked and was like, where are your handcuffs? I had heard all the kind of stuff going on in the place behind, and he said, where are your handcuffs? And the guy was like, I broke them. Like, this one warrior guy, he just busted the handcuffs. And then he said, okay, well, you're gonna have to put them on, and you're gonna be charged for breaking that camera, because he'd busted his handcuffs and smashed the camera in the paddy wagon, which was pretty cool. You know, like, that kind of attitude is, like, I think it keeps adding to the energy and people's, like, feeling of resistance. It's like, yeah, it wasn't over when they cuffed him or whatever. I don't remember it being like super long time, but when we were brought out again, we were at some co-op detachment. I can't even remember which one we brought to. And then everyone was just offered these papers. You know, the cops were like, sign these papers promising you're never going to go back there, you know. And everyone was just signing them. And then there was cars outside, and we were jumping in the cars, and everyone was going right back to the site. And I didn't know what had happened at all, you know, since the raid. But in that short amount of time of me being put in the paddy wagon to when I came back to the site, that place was like blown up. Like it was in the sense of like tons of people were there. There was people ripping around on four wheelers all over the place. The whole road was taken over now.
Highway 6 shut down. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Because I didn't clarify earlier. It was just inside from Highway 6. There was a little access into the building site. And that was the only place that was blocked.
Basically a driveway.
Yeah, exactly. When the raid happened, I guess community members just responded with, you know, with action and pushed the cops back. Like, I've since heard the stories, but I wasn't there at the moment, but I know it was just a matter of hours. And by the time I came back, it was like, it was pretty full on. And then started setting up barricades, and more and more people came down to occupy the site. Yeah.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, there was like tire fires. There was, I think, a bridge got burnt. There was a hydro tower that got felled. There was a lot of stuff that started popping off, not just at Six Nations, but at all the Mohawk communities in Ontario and Quebec, in the few days that followed that raid.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the site was blocked in a number of different access points after that, because there were different access points that the police could have. So there was set up barricades and sort of access control points at a bunch of different spots after. And yeah, I heard about actions going on elsewhere and this and that. And the numbers swelled. Yeah.
And so at first it was a swelling of like Haudenosaunee people from Six Nations, right, who came back and drove the cops away. And then not that long afterwards, there was like busloads of supporters showing up from Toronto, from Kingston, from Guelph, from all over the place. So when you got back to the site, what were the dynamics like at that time? And how did they start to shift with the arrival of more people?
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said, directly when I got back to the site, it was mainly just community members, but like a lot more people than I had ever seen there before. And then I guess there must have been activist groups that were sort of mobilized to respond in the event of a raid, because that evening, I think, maybe the first bus arrived. But I do have this image in my head remembering like it was foggy and this bus arrived and all these supporters, like non-Indigenous supporters, started pouring out, like, and just were like wide-eyed and like bewildered and walking to this foggy sort of place in the night. And but anyway, yeah, the dynamics changed a lot after the raid, to one definitely more of, I guess, what would be called militancy or whatever. Like, there were more barricades actually set up to be defended. And then the initial site where the sacred fire was, that became the site where like supporters were directed to. So the buses would come to this site, and then there were other occupation sites. And I remember at least that the Mohawks had their own sort of site. I think other nations also, like I think that might have been one of the ways that the designated access points were controlled. Was the different nations sort of took on the responsibility of a certain access point and sort of had their own camp out kind of place set up there. I had really valued the time when I was there with less people, because it gave us the chance to have those interactions and to understand each other and to get to know each other more on a personal level and actually create some relationship. And people remembered me, you know, people that I knew from there remembered me when I came back after the paddy wagon took me away. And I think people really appreciated that I had actually been there for the raid, and even though I didn't really get a chance to do much because I was taken out pretty
stumble
fast.
Stumble out of the tent, get
arrested. Yeah, I stumble out of the tent and get taken out, right? But I think people really appreciated that I didn't just step to the side or try to remove myself from being a guilty party or something like that, because I think that was another like thing that, you know, that they were wondering is like, this guy, not from here, white guy, like why is he here, you know, and what's he really going to do? And I think that's a dynamic that's played out in the past, and I think it could still, you know, happen. And I really think that's important for anyone who shows up to these types of things to keep in mind, like, if you're responding to a call, like, be mindful of what call you're responding to and what kind of support you're offering. If you're offering to come down and bring food and blankets and stuff like that, then do that. Come down, bring food and blankets. And, you know, if you're offering to come down and help to build something, then do that. If you're, like, there's all kinds of things you'd be doing. But if you're offering to come and stand on, you know, a blockade and occupy a blockade, then be prepared. You know, if the intention, like, be prepared to go with those people and their intention, whatever that intention is, on how they choose to respond when the police decide to, you know, escalate and move in on those types of things. You know, I feel like, anyway, that's happened in the past, and is one of the reasons why maybe Indigenous communities are sometimes reticent to just simply call for supporters, because what support is that? If you show up and eat and drink and smoke, and then just split, you know, it's like, that's not a worthwhile support, really, and that's more of a burden than solidarity. So, you know, people got to think a lot about what solidarity means and how to enact that.
Struggle. Times is hard on the boulevard, so I bow guard to never get scarred. Brothers calling me God, but I'm living in hell. Duck it one time, ain't no top billing in jail. I was told to watch my back, wise words from a wise man. Stuff for the moment, but another cat already put me up on it. School to the rules of the game at a young age. Telling myself I'ma make it out this one day. Inner city native youth caught up in gunplay. With no guidance, young minds run straight. Where I'm from, young uns be chasing things. That'll only get them shot or locked up. Young girls getting knocked up. Babies having babies, I let it seen it and couldn't believe it. But that's just the way it is. Straight bullets hitting kids, shifting ribs. Small, more funerals. How can I call this life beautiful?
How's it feel to be neglected, never served and protected? Drug and alcohol invested, know your people were molested by a system that expected your demise, self-inflicted. Our youth is infected, bad medicine injected. We're jailed and arrested anytime we protested. So when they violate our rights, they never contested. Spoon feed us the illusion that the crown owns this land. Shape Mother Nature, ball make carpets from our clan. But KK Canada, you stand a guard for the lack of ability to see and keep us bound to slavery. So what's your next step? You steal the truth from the youth when we're looking through the lies, cause this res is living proof. But see, it's hard to follow the great lies of peace. Crooked police of the Northeast that want our kind of cease. 500 years, it's been endless tears. I overconquer all the fears of all the press fears. The foundation of this nation is riddled in deceit. The stare of our hunger, homeway brothers on these streets. The stench of the city as it slowly decays. Says, come roll your dice in a land where the devil plays. Amongst the pimps and whores, monotonous death dealers. The cops with a piece of cheese trying to bait the squealers. Who runs the drug markets? Who makes the bread? It's the upper class society, crooked cops and feds.
When the kings truly tried to extinct our culture, then the clans disrespect the lands. Can't but know how, damn, bloody red man hands, damn. Renegade relics neglect some wine diesel. Never knew that feeling of a ceremonial belief. Young still disbelief, huh? Your colored legs, sugar and love tries to obtain. My chosen pigmentation confused, homie still with Omega, dwelled in the meds. How chose crooked brothers, Ackland to the Daho, last night with Noha, yeah, twist the world, car cripple who acting on needing a fix. I sat back and watched, yo, the devil do his twist, make my people do his deeds. You know what's unspoken, the venom spoken, wampum belt felt broken. Now I took it back to the world around, it's our people, yeah, our people's acting now. So we got battered and bruised, but you know a fire now.
Like, I remember showing, because I was one of the many, many people who showed up, and like, I think it was the day after the raid or maybe 2 days after the raid. And there was just a ton of people and a lot of confusion about who's in charge, who, like, where do you go? Do you have to check in with somebody? And I remember when I got there, at least, that there was a dynamic of certain organizations from Toronto, primarily, who were kind of shepherding supporters and trying to assign roles to people, which I think out of a genuine desire to like make people useful and make that support kind of worthwhile. And it's, you know, I think it's more on me for not having shown up with a plan or a meaningful contribution in mind than it is on them for, you know, taking on that role of trying to guide people. But I also remember that this led to a lot of kind of useless work being done just to try to occupy people. Like, I remember like clean some garbage out of that ditch or like, you know, yeah, stuff that was kind of questionably useful, just to kind of give people a sense of purpose. Right. And I think also a lot of people are not that comfortable hanging around, smoking cigarettes and trying to make friends with people they've never met before. Like, it's a very difficult situation to, like, you know, start a new relationship in. Were you able to kind of bypass all those dynamics because you had those pre-existing relationships and you had certain people that you kind of touched base with when you got back?
I was lucky in that, well, I guess not lucky, it was a result of being there before and having formulated some relationships. So there was this, you know, handful of people who knew me and I knew them and they recognized me and that kind of thing. So we were able to talk and be more normal. I was not like sequestered to the one, you know, supporter area. I had more personal comfort to go and see the friends I had made who were in different areas because I just was comfortable to do that. Whereas, yeah, if that was the first time I had arrived, I might not feel comfortable like stepping out of the zone that I was told, hey, be in the zone, right? There was a guy who I hadn't seen ever before who had taken on, he was a guy from the community of 6NA, and he had sort of taken on a role of like a local police officer, like for the camp. And he was, checking people's IDs, and I don't know what the purpose of him checking IDs was really. He wasn't really running them through a database or anything, but he was seeing IDs, and he was really into taking that approach of control of people, that kind of thing. And I didn't get on with him very well, you know, but I was able, because I had these previous relationships, I was able to go over to the Mohawk camp where I had, you know, I had a couple of friends who were, you know, a couple of warriors there were friends, and I was able to kind of check in and be like, what's this guy's kind of like, you know, controlling and saying that everyone's got to be whatever. And they were kind of like, oh, well, maybe he thinks he controls there, but he don't control here and that kind of thing. Right. Which really exemplified as well. These things, when they get big, you know, there's a lot of different dynamics going on. There's a lot of different people who have different desires, and there's different leadership that can happen. There's different claims to leadership that can happen. And it's not easy to figure out or navigate in those moments. It's actually really quite tricky. So in those moments, I was really at an advantage that at least I had a core group of people who I knew, who I could kind of refer to and be like, what do you think about all this? Because I trusted them, you know, and they trusted me enough to sort of talk to me. And so they could give me like little directions like that. It wasn't so much like, oh, what do you think about this, and airing dirty laundry in front of each other. It was more like little stuff like, is this a problem if I'm like here or whatever? And they're like, no, it's no problem. Right. Like, don't worry about that.
I think also when there's like literally hundreds of people showing up, most of them looking for some kind of direction, there's always going to be some people who try to step into that role. And sometimes they're speaking for others and have some kind of backing in doing so, and sometimes they don't. If you're just getting there for the first time, it's virtually impossible to tell, you know, who's speaking for who here and what are the actual kind of dynamics at play.
Yeah, that's right. You know, these comments are something that more so I think, you know, folks who want to do Indigenous solidarity have to think about their role in that. This is not, I don't want this to be interpreted as saying like, oh, Six Nations did a bad job of controlling this influx of people or something, because I think that's like, it was crazy. And like, were they prepared for that many people? I don't know. Did they think that was going to happen? I don't know what was behind the scenes, which resulted in such an influx of supporters all at once. But I think it's more for folks like me and others who come as with the interest of doing good solidarity to, you know, going through those thought processes and and actually not just being ready to respond at the moment of crisis and having relationships only at the moment of crisis. You know, people should really seriously take that into consideration and do some legwork or something beforehand if they can, which is not always easy either, right? Like, you just come in as a stranger from another community to meet another community. That in itself has all kinds of its own challenges. But the point is, you know, I think it would be worthwhile. And it's not always seen, you know, when people review these kind of things after the math or after the fact. They say, okay, well, this happened. Like even with what's going on with Wet'suwet'en today, for example, you know, it's been going on for years, right?
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, this is one of those moments of heightened, like, attention and everything. And many people from outside will only remember these 2 months. But it has to be remembered that there's been years of buildup. You know, the legwork, that kind of legwork could happen to make things more effective in the moment of crisis, I guess.
And sort of specifically, what do you think are some good examples of what you call legwork in this case, like of that kind of relationship building that can transfer into, you know, connections and relationships of trust that can make more meaningful forms of solidarity possible?
Unfortunately, I don't think I have just an easy answer for that. I mean, every community is going to be different and stuff like that. But if that means, I don't know, going to the local community's powwow or a maybe community events that are open to the public or something, just to sort of start hanging out and maybe you meet a friend. Like, how do we meet any of our friends in all kinds of different ways?
But sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking of like the anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner that happens
right.
In Guelph. Seems to be a good way where
right.
People have built some goodwill in a low stress environment.
Yeah.
Or out west, like you're mentioning, they've been building this for like a decade almost. And there's been regular kind of like building projects and people have kind of jumped at those opportunities to develop those relationships and build that goodwill, which I think has really translated into, you know, like the massive amount of support that exists today for that particular struggle. That combined with, I think, a pretty smart media strategy that is very impactful for so many people.
Right. Yeah, totally. Those are good examples.
How did you eventually decide to leave the camp, and what kinds of relationships did you take with you into the future after that wrapped up for you?
When it became huge, I guess I hung around for some days longer. I think I just decided, you know what, there's tons of people here. These barricades are here. You know, I found myself starting to be surrounded more by settlers, other activist settlers, like rather than indigenous folks. I think that was the main thing. I, you know, earlier on, it was a small thing. It felt good. And it felt like my one body there was useful, in terms of numbers and that kind of thing. So I felt like I was offering something
mm-hmm.
a bit. And then after it just seemed like, okay, they had it covered and I felt like I could go. I think that was really the main thing that just mm-hmm. took me away. I also want to speak to you. I've used that word like offer, like I had something to offer. But really when I reflect on the solidarity I've done, both also in Colombia and in Sixnay, those moments, you know, I was really young when I was doing both those things. I was like 19, 20. Those were really, like, for lack of a better word, educational, like, moments for me, inspiring moments. I really look back on those events as something where I got more than I offered. They really had a strong impact on me, on my development of my own, like, whatever character and politics and commitments. You know, that stuff kind of gets right into your soul when you're around that kind of strength that the people exemplified there. So it does give you, you know, great perspective and I think really adds to your own spirit and your own power. Like, I would think that's a really effective learning tool, I guess. So if you are welcomed and you do get to spend some time in a place like that, like, it's probably actually like a really good thing for someone to do. I know for me it was really important. All that to say, like, we shouldn't just look at the solidarity as like, okay, what am I offering? What am I bringing? What am I giving? And I wouldn't even, and I wouldn't paint my own history with those direct solidarity struggles that I participated in. I wouldn't paint them as like, oh, I gave something to these people. Because by far, they gave something more to me. And I was actually the benefactor of their experience and knowledge. My desires in these types of moments are educated by that now, and they are different than they are than they were then. And part of that's because I've had those opportunities to gain that knowledge and that experience that was given to me by those people. So, yeah, I'm really grateful that I was welcomed in for that. Yeah.
What kinds of lessons about sort of that strength and capacity that you're talking about do you think is possible to take with you into your own struggles and context, and also what a sort of anarchist and indigenous solidarity can look like moving forward?
I kind of think those are two maybe questions I have to answer in two separate ways. Like, when I talk about the strengths and the things I learned there, it's a less, maybe a less tangible thing. It's more like when you personally experience certain moments and how they change whatever your core sort of being or something, and how you relate to the world and how you see things and how you believe you can act. You know, like, to this day, like, I still, if I hear like Mohawk like drumming, like particularly like some of the men's songs that I've heard a lot on the lines, like, even if I hear them, like a sample of them in a song or something, like, I get all these shivers like come all up my body, and like I feel like I just swell or something. You know, and then there's, I mean, there is practical stuff I observed as well, which I'm happy to talk about, like the practicality of the direct action tactic of, like, you want to defend that land, you defend it. You know, you don't, you don't just give up because the court says you can't do that, or we've given it to someone else, or whatever. You know, the diversity of the participants in the struggle, the fact that it wasn't just, you know, a struggle where you could only be a militant or something like that. The diversity, the fact that more like defensive warrior type militants, whatever, could be there, like holding the front line, and people could be bringing them food and smokes, and, you know, setting up tents or whatever, and like these different sort of things where people could be sitting around the fire telling stories, people could be playing music. You know, that diversity of participation, which brought it all and made it a really encompassing thing. And the diversity of skills that people brought as well, in terms of just practical skills. And I think they had a backhoe that dug up the highway. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to drive a backhoe, but it's like, it wasn't much trouble for them to find someone to drive a backhoe and to actually have a backhoe and like dig up the highway and build this barricade. You know, like, I didn't go to any school after my high school. I graduated high school. But I see, like, a lot of time in anarchist circles and activist circles, like, a lot of time it seems to be a bit dominated by, like, university-educated folks. People have gone down a path of way of, like, gaining other knowledge, you know, like, knowledges, like, theories and stuff like that, rather than the knowledge of how to drive a backhoe or how to build a shelter, you know, in a couple hours with your buddies to have a kitchen and that kind of stuff. So I was definitely taking all that in too, and watching, like, you know, these people like bring on all their practical skills and abilities as a community and their supplies and everything, and just like boom, 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 hammer out things that for me and my sort of direct group of friends at the time, like, I don't think many of us had many of those skills. Like, we wouldn't have been able to offer much in that regard. Also, generally, like, being rural, like, that also, like, it had an effect on me, I will say. Like, both in Colombia, it was rural situation. It was, you know, in the jungles, far away from any kind of urban activity. And then Sixnay is sort of like, you know, you'd call it a rural place, not really a, you know, city or whatever. And that different kind of existence versus, like, urban movements and how urban movements often look. And I really appreciated the space and the independence that those rural movements had, you know. They were taking like big areas of space for a long time, rather than, you know, small sections of a city for a short time or something like that. But yeah, those were all things that influenced me, and I think are valuable things.
And I know, like, we've both been involved with relationships with people at Tiny Nega over the years as well, who typically over the years do things quite differently. Rarely are there open public calls to go out when there's an action there. And one idea that's certainly become more present in the Kingston community has been this idea of like multiplying actions as opposed to all necessarily going to the place where the thing starts. So instead, like if somebody stands up and is causing a disruption, that people should be trying to create disruptions all over the place, which is kind of what we've seen with the shutdown Canada thing after the RCMP raids out west. Do you think that's a positive step? Do you think it's, you know, people aren't getting that direct experience with something as strong as you can get when you're sort of present at Tiny Nega or at Six Nations? Or, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally that's a positive step. Obviously, every situation is different and has its own dynamics going on. It would be beautiful, a mix of the two, of course.
Sure.
I guess all things. If you can have it all, that's great, you know? But yeah, like in terms of my orientation toward this solidarity now, I am actually more attracted to the idea of organizing on our own to augment those struggles rather than just to appear at those places. There are those times when to appear like right on those places are important, and I think those have to be heeded. But yeah, as you outlined, like for Tiny Nega, for example, often they don't feel the need to call in other supporters. They feel quite capable as a community to handle it on their own without an influx of supporters. Yeah, so if you've got a passion to offer some support, you know, it's like, this is a nice way to do it. If you can offer some support outside to say, hey, yeah, you know, you're not being asked to come along, but if people are down with getting a little solidarity action or something, if it's good and in the spirit, obviously you have to be mindful of these communities. And even in that, you know, scenario, so when you're acting in solidarity, like you should have, it does go back to this relationship building thing. Like you should have at least some kind of a connection so that at least you know that what you're doing is linked with what they desire, right? Because you don't want to start stepping in and doing exactly what you feel is right when actually they don't really appreciate it, then it's not solidarity anymore. So it is one of those things where still those relationships should be developed because the solidarity actions can be tailored more to be more effective, I think. That said, I mean, with this Wet'suwet'en thing that's going on right now, it'd be very difficult for anyone from this end, being like, you know, so-called Ontario, to develop steady relationships with folks who are way over there, you know, on the West Coast. But they've done a good job of sort of putting out on the media and stuff kind of their desires and their interests in solidarity. And so you can get direction from that. Or if you have your own network of people who have even more direct connections, this is another way to transfer sort of knowledge and get some ideas. But yeah, I think it's been very effective, the shutdown Canada thing. I think it's something that I feel like we're kind of learning from Indigenous folks again. Like it's something that, I mean, I'm not a scholar of all these histories, so I don't know all the different things that happened, but I know definitely, like, you know, as far back as Oka, 30 years ago, at least, the Mohawks already had that going on, where one community was doing something, the other community said, okay, we're going to do something, and something that's going to support you, right? And Wet'suwet'en supported them back then, blocking the rails. So Indigenous folks have already had that concept of how powerful that is, and how it's an effective way to enact your solidarity other than just all centralizing on one location. It's too bad it takes 30 years for, you know, for settlers to get a clue, or at least, you know, it seems like something that's been certainly talked about for a long time and an idea that's been floated around, and it was seen as quite effective in this moment anyway, for a lot of different reasons.
I guess, unless you have more to add, like, I kind of wanted to end by just asking if somebody is listening to this who is, you know, really activated by the current moment with the Wet'suwet'en struggle and solidarity actions and Shutdown Canada and all that. If and when things ebb or whatever, what advice would you have for how to sort of carry forward and continue kind of like engaging in solidarity and anti-colonial struggle without the kind of crisis sort of level of activity that we've seen over the last couple months?
Right. Well, I think if people have been engaged in solidarity and have been going out there, I would hope that they've made some personal connections. And I would say, you know, try to maintain those. If you made a connection with someone that you like to chat with out there or something, you know, find them after the fact and maintain that connection. Get to know them a little more, whatever. Or like on the more structural side, like you had mentioned the example of like, you know, the anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner, you know, like think about maybe organizing something on your own way where you can, you know, kind of ask for participation, you know, ask if there's interest for participation from your neighboring indigenous community or what have you, and see if there are people who come out and are like, yeah, we're into participating in that and into building those relationships. Mainly I would hope that through these moments of struggle and solidarity, and there have been a lot of people, I know out of Kingston at least, like there have been a real range of people who've gone down and supported the folks there and everything. I would hope that they've made a couple of friends, that they got a chance to talk to people, and that they don't just leave it when things sort of seem to have died down or whatever, you know? Yeah, I guess that's what I would say.
I'm living on the reserve my whole life. Six nations, a territory. True Res Crew. From an early age, from behind the cage, we imprisoned by the system that we live in, but I'm never giving in to the rage. Curling the page, enlightenment, the way we were, the things we had. How can life seem so bad? It's like a whole mentality was murdered. I bring it back to reality. Thoughts inserted by the enemy, the penalty. Carefully worded, I heard my dad speaking to me, saying, son, don't worry, stand your ground no matter what. My face got cut when I rose up against the opposition, fighting for my family, my life and my vision. That's why he's only seen me roll with a few, chosen and true. Struggling, but we making it through. So if a body come around here thinking we weak, better understand the history. My people is deep, six nations. That's the spot that I rap the res, keep you in check. From your Tim's to your neck, I come correctly. Lodeskin legete, no matter what pops off, we ready. We ready.
Six nations, that's the land I'm from. That's the spot where it all begun. Round here we throw down, son. We don't need no gun. You learn to stand your ground and never run. Six nations, home of the brave. Seventh generation, born in the age of war and pain, where a lot of brothers live fast, looking old in their face. Brothers is laying flat, cold in their grave. This where the mongrel holy flags fly full mast. This six grand, the spot where all my seeds with birth. We from the biggest res, the biggest on earth. And since day one, we've been putting in work. Now the last shall be first. You feeling my thirst? Cause round here you can get it. The six snake territory filled with shorty down in 40s, waiting for their dead glory. No respect for authority. You know the same sad story is being scribed, but true res gonna bring back that native pride. Teach the babies to see through the fakes and lies. That's the way I'm raising mine.
Yeah, you know? Yo, it's the land I'm from, it's that six name zoo. Our peeps went through pain and ridicule. Silly fools didn't acknowledge. It's the chose you mess with, you test with that acid slang. I ain't never gonna stop like acid rain and hand slang, but this land's what made me. I ain't never gonna break me, cause you know I'm from that six name zoo. It's the place where you're pushed at a place you want. on a patrol, want some studies on, but we ain't never gonna leave. Breathe, another good day, but it's that six, does have some twists and turns, depths of incoherence that effects don't learn. Crooks still burn, but they still gonna be uncertain. Yeah, y'all turn to fix, but the solution's unfixed. Yo, six kicks, a hole in your speaker. Weak to info by that science speaker. Y'all learn the sixth sense. Dude, I'm on the tenth, it's intense. I wanna see that Hall of Famer. Yeah, come check again. It's another form, but warned, y'all want tests. We gon' be the goal for to infiltrate what's ours from these starters, sisters, brothers. It's that six day suit.
My name is Alia. I'm at CKUT in Montreal. 90.3 FM. Keep on rocking in the free world.
Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on rocking
in the free world. The following is a previously broadcast program.
Ça va? Super. Pas pire pantoute. Numéro 1. Ça roule? Bien, merci. C'est cool. Comme sur des roulettes. Ben correct. Quand on se fait demander comment ça va, on dit souvent que tout va bien, même si c'est pas toujours le cas. Si ça ne va pas, parlez-en. Pour trouver de l'aide, appelez InfoSocial 811. Parce que parler, c'est commencer à aller mieux. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
L'épidémie mondiale de la COVID-19 a affecté les vies de chacun de différentes manières. Elle a également attiré notre attention sur l'intensification du racisme systémique et de la xénophobie sélective envers nos amis racisés dans notre société canadienne. Il est compréhensible que chacun d'entre nous se sente anxieux face à cette maladie dangereuse. Cependant, ce sentiment d'angoisse